Now, there's one thing for certain. I think if we would look at the total population of the earth, and to view that total population of the earth from God's viewpoint, I think we would have to agree that there are not very many righteous people on the earth. In fact, the truth of the matter is that the righteous people on the earth in all periods of time have been in a very, very, very small minority. But the matter of being righteous is a very, very serious and important matter, because as Peter wrote here in 1 Peter 4, verse 18, well, beginning in verse 17, "For the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God, and if it first begin at us, what shall be the end of them that obey not the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and sinner appear?" So the Bible candidly says that the righteous will scarcely be saved. So if that's the case, it should behoove all of us to want to know what righteousness is and how we can attain it. Now, a dictionary definition of the word righteous, and this is looking at it from a non-biblical viewpoint, although we can certainly amplify it to include righteousness from God's vantage point or God's viewpoint. A dictionary definition would simply say that righteousness is the quality of being right or just. The quality of being right or just. But I might add, that in itself is a very deficient definition, because it fails to take into consideration that every culture and society has its own standard of righteousness. What is acceptable in our Western civilization, which has become largely hedonistic, would not be acceptable at all in a Muslim world, and what may be perfectly acceptable in the Orient would not be acceptable in the Jewish society. So you see, that definition must be, let's say, altered, or must be augmented by saying that righteousness is the quality of being right or just based on the permanent righteous standard of God. In other words, the very definition of righteousness itself demands an unchanging standard of perfection by which to be judged. All right, if that defines righteousness. Now, what we're really saying there, in effect, is that to be right is to be the opposite of wrong. And if one is right, he is correct or has the truth, as opposed to someone who is not and is in error. Now, the Bible does very clearly state that God's church has preserved the truth. Notice in 1 Timothy 3, verse number 15, Jesus made the promise himself. He said, "Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world," or even to the end of the age, which meant that Jesus would be guiding and directing whatever that segment of people that composes his true people, and they would have the truth. Because Paul put it here when he wrote to the young evangelist Timothy, and he said, "If I tarry long," that is the purpose of that I'm writing this letter, is that in the case I tarry long, you may know how you ought to behave yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth. So the true church has the truth. And the truth is, of course, the correct biblical understanding in those areas which God has made plain and revealed. The reason I say that is because I think we all recognize there are areas that God has not yet revealed, and they will not be made known until after the coming of Christ, the second coming of Christ. But if I would use the Bible definition of the word righteous and righteousness, I could summarize it by one simple statement in the Psalms here, Psalm 119, verse 172, "My tongue shall speak of thy word, for all thy commandments are righteousness." Now, the problem with the concept that every Sabbath-keeping church is in itself a part of God's true church, even though there may be differing doctrinal opinions here and there, is really begging the issue, because this statement says here, all thy commandments are righteousness, which means in plain language, the very moment any human individual or any church draws a line on God's commandments and God's law somewhere along the way and refuse to obey those commandments and those laws, they cannot be God's true people for long. We have Seventh-day keeping groups that keep the holy days, and some do not. There are Seventh-day keeping groups, you know, that are just as free and open on the concept of divorce and remarriage as any Protestant church. In fact, some are even worse now. So the point I want to make is that if we're going to define righteousness as the keeping of God's commandments, this particular text right here says, all thy commandments are righteous. Which means then that the people of God who are his true people do not draw a line on any of God's commandments and God's laws. Now we know, of course, there are certain segments of the instruction in the Old Testament that were not intended to be carried over into our day to day. The sacrificial system, various washings, ceremonies, physical ceremonies of one type or another having to do with the Levitical priesthood and so forth. Those were not to be carried over. But every other principle and law and rule in the Bible was intended to be carried over. If not directly in an actual physical configuration, certainly in principle, as we can apply those situations in our own daily and private and personal lives. So we see very plainly then that the Bible defines righteousness as God's law and God's commandments, and that is the inexorable, perfect, permanent spiritual standard by which we are enabled to judge everything. All right, if that's what the Bible then defines as righteousness, now let's just take a look at ourselves as individuals. And let us ask ourselves, as we're going through these, how many of these apply to us, because what I'm going to do now is just to give a series of texts here that demonstrate from the Bible who a righteous person is. I'm not saying by this that this is complete. In fact, if we wanted to be exhaustive, we could probably find hundreds of texts that would deal with the subject. But since I'm just covering this in one sermon to give you a working knowledge of the Bible definition of righteousness, then let us look at these particular texts here and ask to what degree they apply to ourselves. Let's go to Psalm 31, first of all. Psalm 31, and in verse number 18, what do we read here? Let the lying lips be put to silence, which speak grievous things proudly and contemptuously against the righteous. So I can tell you this, the Bible says that if you're a righteous person, you're going to be spoken against. And it isn't going to be because you've gone out and solicited criticism. We know there are organizations and groups that go around knocking on people's doors and as a result bring upon themselves scorn and derision and contempt of one type or another, and in most of those cases they ask for it. But what I'm talking about is if you are truly a righteous person, remember, righteousness is defined as all of God's commandments, and if you're a truly righteous person, you cannot blend in and be a part of this society in this world. The things that are near and dear to you cannot be and must not be what is near and dear to this society in this world. Now, you know, we all sat here and we heard a couple of beautiful numbers done by the choir. That's what music can be. But if your musical tastes are those of the world, particularly certain types of music, I'm not saying all music is bad by any means, but let me just limit it to rock music, let's leave it at that for right now, and you enjoy that beat, and you enjoy that dissonance, and you enjoy those microtones, and you're tied into that kind of a, let's say, attraction, and that is pleasing to you, then I can tell you this, that makes you a part of the world. Now that makes some people angry when you tell them that, but I mean, you know, you are what you follow and you practice and you do what you enjoy. And if you enjoy those things that make up the fundamental concepts and principles of this world, the world isn't going to hate you, it's going to love you. I mean, if your home is one where you turn up the hi-fi and you open up the doors and windows and rock music as loud as it can go so it can be heard several blocks, the world's going to love you. You know, in general, there might be some old fogies, you know, that came back from the Lawrence Welk era that don't appreciate that. But you know, back in those days, they had better taste for music, too. But I mean, in general, if you're going to be accepted by your peers and the society around you, you're going to be doing the things the world enjoys, and you're going to be wanting to participate in those things the world enjoys, and the world's going to be your friend. It isn't going to hate you, it's going to love you. What I mean to say by that is, if you are truly a righteous person, you will not be able to blend. There will be no common ground by which you can find an association with these things. And if you cannot find an association with these things and these common grounds, people are going to look on you as odd. And they're going to speak about you. And they're going to speak against you. Generally behind your back. But it will nevertheless be done. So don't ever forget that. You want to identify yourself, you want a Bible definition of what a Christian is. Then I can say that you are going to be sufficiently well enough known by some people who are going to be criticizing you behind your back, maybe even to your face. If no one knows you, and no one knows what you believe, and they can't tell anything about the way you live, that you're any different than anybody else, then I would suggest you start taking a little careful look at yourself. Because I can tell you this, if you work with people, you associate with people, you become acquainted with people, there's going to come a time in many areas, certainly in some areas, maybe many areas, where people are going to automatically recognize and know you are different. It cannot be helped. And if you're different, you're going to be criticized. So let me just say very plainly here, the Bible says that you're going to be spoken of. And if you're not, then I'd suggest you start taking a careful look at what you're doing or what you're not doing. That's one area. All right, let's go to Psalm 37 and notice another here. Psalm 37, beginning here in verse number 39. The salvation of the righteous is of the Lord. In other words, they're not going to save themselves by their Gnostic concepts of the divinity and man and all that kind of thing. In fact, the other day I received a copy of an article taken from some Canadian publication, some religious publication, written by a former minister of the Church of God, who made the remark in this particular article that the thing that saved him and will save anybody from these cults, these authoritarian cults like the Worldwide Church of God, is humanism. Humanism saved him. Well, this is what the Bible says. You know, you're not going to save yourself by your own efforts, and humanism is going to save no one. The Lord shall help them and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked and save them because they trust in him. So what is an identifying sign of the righteous? They trust God. Now, how many people put their trust in man first? What most people will tend to do is that they will try to work out their own problems or their own salvation, their own difficulties, and God will be the last one they ever go to. And the only time they go to God, you know, is if nothing else works. It's much like, you know, you've read these little jibes, which is certainly true. When all else fails, read the instruction manual. Well, that's the way a lot of people are. They'll go to God as a last resort. They never think about trusting God first in anything. And every single problem that they face in this life, whether it's a material problem, an economic problem, a health problem, a social problem, whatever it may be, there's some man-made solution supposedly to deliver them. But the righteous, it says here, they trust in him. So certainly one of the important identifying signs of a true person, a righteous person, is whether or not he trusts God. He thinks about God. He's concerned about God. He takes God into consideration in everything he does. So let's keep that in mind. When problems arise and difficulties arise, let's be asking ourselves, you know, not that I'm saying everybody has perfect faith and everybody should do the same thing under the same circumstances. I cannot judge that. That is only a matter that you yourself can judge as an individual under the circumstances. But I think we all ought to be honest enough with ourselves to be asking ourselves these questions. And when trials and difficulties arise, do we really make an effort to look to God first and foremost and always? That is one of the identifying signs of the righteous. Now, there may be some things we can do about it. In fact, generally, in most cases, there are things we must do about it. But we should realize that the real solution rests with God. And then let's get back over to verse 21 of this same chapter. And here's another statement. Here's another identifying sign of a righteous person. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again. I remember years ago we had some neighbors that lived next door. And I don't think there was a day that didn't go by that they didn't come over to borrow something. It was never, may I have it? You know, they would come over and say, may I borrow some butter? May I borrow some sugar? May I borrow a cup of flour? May I borrow this, borrow that? Every single thing was always borrowed. And never was it ever returned. It was a kind of a standing joke in our family because every time we saw one of them coming, we'd say, uh-oh, somebody want to borrow something again. Well, they were just little minor things. Wasn't anything really significant. We didn't mind doing it, but it's just the idea that they used the word borrow when they'd been better off and said, well, look, you know, I don't have any sugar. Can I have a little sugar? You know, at least it wouldn't have been couched in some kind of a euphemism, which really meant, can I have it? And they used the word borrow. But anyway, to go on here, the wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. So what does a righteous person do? A righteous person is not always thinking about number one. Any of you have ever been in the military service, you'll find that you get about the last 3 or 4 days, maybe 5 days before payday, a good percentage of these guys will be walking up and down the streets looking for snipes they can pick up and smoke. And they'll be going around hitting everybody up for money. You know, can I borrow five? You know, they'll say, how about lending me five? And here's what a lot of guys will do. They will just hold off some of their money until about the last week. Then when these fellows will come around borrowing, they'd say, yeah, I'll give you five for 10 payday. I'll give you 10 for 20 payday. A lot of them will do it. In other words, I'm not saying these fellows deserve to have any money. That's not the point. You know, if they couldn't handle their, a lot of them would lose it, you know, they'd lose it in gambling the next day after payday. You'll see them sitting around there throwing dice, big wads of bills, the biggest round as this speaker stand here and about that high, and rolling those galloping dominoes. The next day after payday, they're broke. Thank God they had the army where they could get 3 meals a day and a bed at night. But the point is, there were men there that were willing to take advantage of these, you know, incompetents, I guess you'd have to call them, that couldn't handle their finances, and they would get 100% profit back on a little loan for payday. But what does the Bible say here? The righteous showeth mercy and giveth. So just keep in mind, when situations arise, you know, you ask yourself, how do you react under these circumstances? You know, that's the reason I've always felt. I've commented on this before. I can walk down the street or, you know, I might pull into a rest area on the highway or something and you're liable to have somebody bumming you for a dollar or so. I give them a dollar or so. Why not? Now, if he would come up and he'd say, I'd like to borrow $100, it'd be another matter. But they usually say, you know, can you give me a dollar or something like that? Why make a big deal over that? Chances are you'd waste, your 50 cents or your 75 cents or your dollar on something else anyway. I remember years ago, there was a Mexican fellow that came up to me, and I had, I think, 50 cents or a quarter in my pocket, something like that. And he had a nice Levi jacket. Some of you have seen those Levi jackets that were lined in a kind of a flannel, you know, lined with flannel. And it was a nice looking Levi jacket. It was practically brand new. And he wanted a beer, I think, of so bad that he was going to sell me that jacket for a quarter. He said, I'll let you have it for a quarter. You know what I did? I just gave him the quarter. I didn't want his jacket. Now sure, you could say, well, why did you contribute to his drinking his beer? Well, I don't know what he did with the money. All I know is he wanted a quarter. And I did not have the heart to take that jacket, which was worth several dollars. You know, back in those days, that was back in the late 40s or early 50s. And I can remember 1954, I went down and bought two pair of jeans to work with, and they cost me $4 a piece, and I thought it was outrageous to pay that kind of a price for jeans. Yeah, that's right. That jacket was probably worth $10. And he was going to sell it for a quarter. But you see, ask yourself how you react in circumstances like that. If somebody comes up and wants to bum a quarter or 50 cents or a dollar off you, what are you going to do? Well, you might be better off, true, you might be better off to say, well, what do you want it for? And he says, I want it for a pack of cigarettes or something. I might have some second thoughts on that. But if he wanted a meal or something, I'd take him over and order a hamburger or something. But the point is, somebody who is a righteous person, it says here, he shows mercy and he gives. He's not thinking always just about himself and what he can get all the time. And he doesn't make himself a judge. I'd say that's probably the biggest problem we had with that whole thing in the past, and that is we were judging a man's circumstances, how he got in that status in life and what he was going to do with it, when in reality, there's no way that you or I or anybody else can undo in one 50-cent piece or $1 what has taken place to develop in this man over 30, 40, or 50 years. Jesus said, you have the poor with you always. So he said, when you give your alms, then do such and such. In other words, don't blow your trumpet about it. But he certainly showed the principle of giving alms. So that's just a characteristic I'm calling your attention of the righteous. Another example is in Psalm 140, verse 13. Surely the righteous shall give thanks unto thy name. How much do you thank God for the things you have? How much do you thank God for your circumstances and for your lot in life and for all the beneficent things that he gives you? Thanks to God, you know, for the rose and for the blue sky and all of the beautiful, lovely things that make up this earth and make up life and everything. How thankful are you for those things, and how much do you thank God for those things? You know, you read the example that Jesus gave in the Bible of the 10 lepers that were healed, and how many came back and thanked him? One. And as human beings, we do have a tendency to take things for granted. Do you take things for granted? And are you not appreciative for all of the beneficent things that you have, really, even though by some people's standards we may be regarded as poor, yet by other people's standards we'd be regarded as wealthy? So just ask yourself the question, you know, the next time the situation arises, when you put a little thought into it, of all the magnificent beneficences that God has bestowed upon you, how thankful are you for those things, and do you thank God for them? All right, that's another mark then. Someone who's a righteous person is not going to be an ingrate. An ingrate is a person who the more he gets, the more he expects to get, and he's never thankful for anything. In fact, it's almost an example of the dog that bites the hand that feeds him. So just keep in mind, God is not satisfied with ingrates, and one of the characteristics it says here very plainly of a righteous person is that he gives thanks to thy name. And that doesn't mean he sits there and says, oh, thank you, Yahweh, 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 Yahweh. It's not talking about how you pronounce the so-called sacred name at all. The word name has about a dozen different meanings in the Bible. All right, now, let's go to the Proverbs and see a few more examples here. Let's go over to Proverbs, the 10th chapter, verse number 32. And what do we read? Another characteristic of the righteous as being? The lips of the righteous know what is acceptable. Now, why do the lips of the righteous know what is acceptable? Because they have a standard of right and wrong. And that standard is based on God's law. And God's law is a law of love. We don't always live up to it perfectly. But, you know, I would say this. You might find people who are very conscious of how they use their tongues. And that's good. But that in itself doesn't necessarily make them a righteous person, because there may be all kinds of other areas in their life they're violating against God's law and God's commandments. But I would say this, that anybody who is truly a righteous person and is really seeking to obey God will not be a person who uses all kinds of profanity and foul language and does not control his tongue. I remember I went quail hunting with a fellow back in the Midwest, and he took me down to a neighboring city where he had an associate in that city who knew where all the quail were supposed to be. And one of the men in that adjacent firm went with us on that quail hunting trip, and I never experienced anything like that in my life. This fellow, he had one curse word, and that was to take God's name in vain. But he had it down to such an exact science that every single time he said it, he had a different inflection on it. He had an inflection on it if he were surprised. He had an inflection on it if he were mad. He had an inflection on it if he stubbed his toe. He had an inflection on it if he saw something pretty. Every single thing that came up, he would use God's name with a different kind of inflection. I bet you I heard 50 different inflections of cursing and taking God's name in vain that day. And between that and the cigarette smoking, the fellow I wrote down with, I got home and I had a headache for about 3 days. Furthermore, I didn't even get any quail. But you see now, why did this fellow use this kind of language? He had no knowledge. No knowledge of God's law. He had no knowledge of the third commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. So you see, somebody who's righteous is going to be a person, and I'm not going to just limit it to using profanity, like for speech in general, and having a good ability to speak and to convey one's thoughts, so forth, might not be balanced, or let's say gifted in the use of the King's English, but we certainly can be gifted in being considerate and being kind and not using foul language. That's why it says there. So just ask yourself the question, you know, what category, where do you fit in this particular area here? The lips of the righteous know what is acceptable. But the mouth of the wicked speaketh frowardness. Haughty, contemptuous, self-willed, foul. You know, it's just, if you've been around people like that, it is not a pleasant experience, is it? All right? Let's go to Proverbs 15 now. Proverbs 15, verse number 28. Here's another characteristic of a righteous person. The heart of the righteous studies to answer. But the mouth of the wicked pours out evil things. So what is that saying? Well, that is saying that if a person is trying to be righteous, he will try to give some thought into what he says. He isn't going to just blurt off whatever is on the top of his head all the time, because it says the mouth of the wicked poureth out evil things. He doesn't study and stop and study about what he's going to say and what the consequences of what he says could be. You know, there are people who've lost their lives over a slip of the tongue. Just a simple word or a simple phrase has cost them their lives. That's why it says here, the heart of the righteous studies to answer. So he tries to think out what he's going to say. He tries to be wise and introspect in how he uses his tongue. But it certainly is a characteristic of the righteous. In other words, he's going to be a person who is going to be cognizant of the importance of saying the right things and using his tongue in the right manner. Go back. Here's another area most people wouldn't think of with respect to a righteous person. But here's what it says in Proverbs 12, verse number 10. The righteous man regards the life of his beast, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. In other words, a righteous person is going to be concerned about his stock or his pets, whatever the case may be. He's going to be cognizant and aware of their needs, and he certainly is not going to be a type of a person who's cruel and has no compassion or consideration even for an animal. You know, animals were not made in the same plane and level as men, and I don't think there's an animal that ever walked along the face of the earth asking himself, am I going to be saved? I don't believe God even gave them that capability or that, let's say, type of intelligence or intellect where they could even concern themselves with the problem. But man has to concern himself with the problem. In fact, man is the only creation on this earth that must concern himself with the problem of salvation. Therefore, it is expedient that he take time to ask himself if he's going to be saved and if he is meeting God's standard of righteousness. And one of the characteristics it says here, the righteous man regards the life of his beast. Now, I think there was a big write-up in the papers here, wasn't it, this last winter or the winter before, about some person here local in the area that I think the county officers had to come down and investigate and take away this person's, what was it, horses that were starving to death. You need to remember that incident. Well, I don't know all the reasons behind it. Maybe the people didn't have any money to feed the horses and just thought, well, maybe they had decided, I guess, that maybe they just tried to make it through the winter without feeding them. Well, I don't know the particular circumstance. But those animals were starving to death. And the authorities stepped in. And probably they should have done so. I mean, you know, we have an organization. They have organizations that are actually set up to prevent people from being abusive and cruel to animals. Because some people are. Now, if they were righteous, and everyone were righteous, you'd never have to worry about that. Because they would be thinking about the best interests of their stock or their pets or whatever may be involved here. But the righteous man regards the life of his beast. The tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. Even somebody who is wicked, if he tries to be kind, he's cruel. He can't be. There's no way he can be kind. So just remember then that it is necessary to even take that into consideration. Now, Proverbs 13, verse number 5, what do we read here? Here's another example of what a righteous man is. A righteous man hateth lying. He hates it in himself, and he hates it to see it in others. And if he has not come to the place where he despises lying, and he prevaricates, he's gotten into a habit. Many people do. They're inveterate liars because they grew up as little children lying. It was never checked on them. They didn't have the parents that were diligent enough to get that habit of lying out of them. And say they grew up as adults and they just lie all the time. It's a way of life today. They're inveterate liars. Now, if you're a righteous person, you're going to despise that. You're going to hate it in yourself, and you're certainly going to hate it in others. And every time you ever catch yourself doing it, you'll check yourself, and you will not do it. You'll take every effort never to be a liar, and certainly to cultivate that habit, because that's exactly what it is. It is a habit. Have you ever known people? I have. You could not believe a word that comes out of their mouths. Every single thing they say, you take with a grain of salt. All right, just remember, God hates lying, and any person who's a righteous person will despise lying. He'll despise it in himself if he sees it, and he certainly will not condone it in others. Now, that doesn't mean that you need to stand up and make a big scene, you know, and somebody's obviously telling a lie. But I can tell you this, it doesn't take very long to spot a liar and to know who one is. And after that, you don't trust anything they say. You know, that's a strange thing about lying. You can tell the truth 99 times. And if you tell one lie, the lie will never be forgotten. All the truth you ever told will be overlooked. That's why it's important not to allow lying to become any kind of a habit. And as it says here, the righteous hate it. Now, there's one other I want to add to this before we look into the New Testament here as to see what really brings about righteousness. But let's go here to the book of Peter, 2 Peter 2, verse number 7. And anybody who's a righteous person is going to be experiencing this. There isn't any way you can avoid it. Here it talks about a righteous man who is called Just Lot. Now, I don't know why he preferred to reside in Sodom and Gomorrah, whichever city he was in, or whether they were adjacent cities or what. Maybe he had a business there, and he didn't have no economic way he could escape. You know, there are any number of reasons why people are in circumstances or in, or why they stay that way. A lot of cases, they don't have any power to change it. But this is not taking into consideration why he left. God delivered him, you know. You remember the angels came right down and practically drug Lot and his wife out, and his two daughters. But here's what the Bible is talking about. And delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. For that righteous man dwelling among them and seeing and hearing vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. He was miserable in that existence. And he was upset constantly by the things that were going on. Isn't that true today for any righteous person? You can pick up the newspapers and read the newspapers and get sick. You can turn on a television set and watch the news and get upset and sick practically. You can pick up a magazine and start reading it and it'll make you sick. You hear about all the things that are going on and it's just disturbing and distressing constantly. Is it not? If you're a righteous person, I'll tell you, you will be vexed by what goes on in this world. You will be upset. Now, you can't change it. There's anything you or I or anyone else can do about it except Jesus Christ. He will change it. Jesus, the coming King, to bring a happy and a peaceful world. Something this world has never really known. But here was just, the Bible says, just Lot. He was a righteous man. And he was vexed constantly by what went on there. So anyone who is a righteous person certainly cannot escape being vexed by what goes on in this society about us today. Whether it's as bad as Sodom was, I don't know. But it's plenty bad enough, even if it isn't. All right, now let us go to one other question here with respect to this topic, and that is, how does righteousness really come about? Can you gain it by your own human efforts? Well, there was a people who tried to. They fell flat on their faces. They don't know it even to this day. And they came to the place where they evolved a law by which they should follow as a nation and as a people. And you know what that law now contains? 613 do's and don'ts. That's how they're righteous. That's why Paul said here, in Romans 10, verse number 1, brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. For I bear them record that they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, are going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. So you see, they did not want God's plan to bring about righteousness, which could only come by means of acceptance of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and calling upon Him. They wanted to do it their own stubborn way. And so today they have 613 do's and don'ts. Now how would you like to go through a single day where you had to keep your eye on a roster that had 600 rules on it? How many days could you go by without breaking one of those 613 rules? So it just demonstrates that people try to attain righteousness, all right, but if your righteousness is based on your own human effort and what you think you're capable of doing, and you're good because you yourself are just special, well, that's only a delusion. That's why he says here, Christ is the end, or the end result, or the purpose of the law. That's what that really means. So what they were doing with respect to trying to keep God's commandments was pointing to Christ and the ability that they would receive by accepting His sacrifice in payment for their past sins and receiving the Holy Spirit so they could live within a spiritual, let's say, declension. Something they'd never had earlier. Well, I should say spiritual dimension. So, as he goes on to say here, picking it up, now he's talking here about this particular type of righteousness, and you know, really what it boils down to is a matter in God's promises and in God's works. And then he summarizes it here in verse 9, that if you shall confess with the mouth the Lord Jesus and shall believe in thine heart that God has raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. Because notice verse number 10, for with the heart man believes unto righteousness. That's right, that's the end result. If you have confidence and faith in God and in his word and in his promises and in his son Jesus Christ, and you repent of breaking God's commandments and God's laws, and you turn around and go the other way, what's the end result of it going to be? Righteousness. But you will never make those moves unless you believe with all your heart. What about people who have accepted the Sabbath? They have a certain amount of biblical knowledge where they can read and they accept the fact that the 7 days should be kept all right, but they don't really have any real faith and confidence in God. How long do you believe that they would last keeping that 7 day if it was going to cost them their job and their means of livelihood? You see, someone is not going to give up his job and his means of livelihood unless he believes with all his heart. And God's truth and his belief in God is the most important thing in his life. Now that's how righteousness is attained. It isn't going to come about by any human effort. And it isn't going to come about by pulling oneself up by his own bootstraps. It's not going to come about, you know, by your determination that you're going to do such and such, because in reality, when it gets down to the real problems of mastering and overcoming these human weaknesses, they cannot be overcome except by means of God's help. Years ago, I visited a woman in Denver, Colorado. She was smoking at the time, and she wanted to be baptized. And I told her she'd probably have to be baptized before she could overcome her smoking, because she probably wouldn't be able to overcome it unless she were baptized. She said, just leave me be. She said, you just give me a few months, give me 6 months, she said, and I'll have this thing whipped, and then I'll be ready to be baptized. Well, about a year later, she came back practically on her knees begging to be baptized, because she knew she could not overcome it on her own. She could not master it. You see, there are things that one may be able to overcome reasonably easy. But I'm sure that there's not a single person sitting in this room that does not have some major problem that you know that you have not been able to master yet. Maybe in some cases several problems, but you know you have not been able to master them yet, and you will go on fighting them probably as long as you live. And I'll include myself in that too. Because we've got to have the power and the strength and the help of God to overcome those things. Now that is going to require faith. And faith is belief in God and in his word and an absolute confidence that God exists and that what he says in this word is true, and he's going to live up to his promises and he's going to keep his word. That's why Paul said here, Hebrews 11 verse number 6, without faith it is impossible to please him. Why? Because if you don't have faith, what will happen is the first rough road comes along, you'll just throw up your hands and quit. It's a man that hangs in there, and because of his absolutely, because he believes with all his heart, and he is not going to give up. He's going to hang on because he's got faith and confidence in God and in his word and in his promises. That's the man who eventually will overcome. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he that cometh to God must believe that he is. In other words, he that comes to God must believe that God exists. He has absolute confidence in God's existence and God's presence. And furthermore, that he, that is God, is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. That if they stay on the track and they hang on and they never give up, they will be rewarded eventually. Now, God may generate some kind of circumstances in our lives to serve as a catalyst to really make us move in the right direction. Sometimes he does that. You know, we've been dragging along too long in, you know, in a problem, and then God will just give us a little impetus. That's good. That's what we need. But the fact nevertheless remains, it's only going to be done by God and by His power. Just remember, as we read in James 2, verse 20, faith without works is dead. There must be an effort made on your part to do what you can. Now maybe you can't do too much, but you better be doing something. God isn't going to come along and just do it for you. He wants you to build character. And He wants you to master the self, and He wants you to become a righteous person. But it's going to take an effort on your part. So just remember, in closing, I will just read this text once again here to you from Romans 10, because this really summarizes the whole thing in a nutshell. It says, "For with the heart man believes unto righteousness." If you believe with your whole heart, then you will be doing the very best you can to overcome and to master yourself and be a righteous man, and God will give you the necessary help to make it so and to be able to fulfill it in your life.